It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here. It's Sunday morning. 66 degrees here. I was going to say Wall Street, but it's really Peachtree. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Dow down 2% on the week. Tariffs unexpectedly return. And we are back at a stalemate. We're back at a trade standoff. Still not going to call it a trade war. But it continues to not get done. What are we talking about today here on Money Matters? The topics today, the tariff fight between the U.S. and China continues on. Uber. Really, Uber, biggest U.S. IPO in a very, very long time, but maybe one of the biggest disappointments in a very long time when it comes to an IPO. We're going to talk about that. We've been highlighting IPOs over the last several weeks because we are in a season of IPOs after pent-up demand, call it a decade of a dribble of IPOs, and now we're getting these multi-billion dollar IPOs week after week after week. But they're relatively disappointing, and Uber's IPO this week was no different than that. Just a big disappointment on Wall Street, and the problem we're seeing here is that investors are not convinced that Hail Mary economics is going to work. What is Hail Mary economics? Hail Mary economics is this: that last week we discussed how you need both money and you need time in order to become a profitable company on Wall Street. Most companies don't get any company that goes public, they get the money. It doesn't mean they get the time. Plenty of capital, plenty of money, but if it only lasts for a year or two or three and you're running out of money, then Wall Street historically drives you to zero, drives your bonds to zero, eventually drives your stock to zero. And ever since Amazon was the Hail Mary in the end zone out of 100 companies that didn't make it or have seen much far worse fates, investors are still hoping for and praying for, well, we're at the 30 yard line. We have 70 yards to go, or 80. We have 70, 75, 80 yards to go, and we're gonna throw it up into the end zone, and maybe, just maybe, we're gonna find a profitable company. And that's really what's happening with all of these big IPOs. Particularly, so Lyft a couple of weeks ago, losing money. This week, Uber losing more money in a quarter than Lyft arguably lost, maybe lost in an entire year. So here we stand with investors saying, okay, we'll buy these shares, but we have no idea if this company is going to be profitable anytime soon. And they've even said that. Uber in their S-1 said, we may never achieve profitability. Yet investors are valuing this company over $50 billion. But they are hoping for, just like what happened with Amazon, over the course of a decade, they will get so big and so much scale that eventually they can turn on the profit spigot. So let's say this is the Hail Mary economics is, hey, we're going to lose. We're going to lose for a long time. And then we're going to lose long enough that we're going to get scale because we have enough cash from investors and debt. So we may continue to borrow money just like Tesla's doing. They're not profitable, losing billions of dollars. But there is a chance, the Hail Mary chance, that it all works out. Do they have a great product? Absolutely. If you've been in a Tesla, it's an amazing vehicle. Is there enough demand in the United States and around the world to make it a viable company to continue to be profitable quarter after quarter? The jury is still out. What would happen to Tesla if the bond market didn't believe that, hey, maybe in the end we can turn this thing into a profitable company? They'd go out of business. They don't have enough cash to survive 6 months even. So the only way for them to continue to survive is to go to the debt market and say, hey, guys, we need another $2.7 billion to continue to operate, let's call it the next leg of the race. And during that leg of the race, maybe we'll get profitable. So debt holders will say, okay, we're going to give you $2, $3 billion. And we believe that if we give you another extension here, things are going to be okay. the jury's still out. The jury's still out for Tesla. The jury took a decade for Amazon to really work. But look at the – so Amazon is the poster child for Hail Mary economics. It worked. It worked. Losing, losing, losing. All of a sudden now the most – arguably the, one of the top three biggest companies in the entire – on the entire planet with the founder Jeff Bezos as the richest person in the world. And it all worked out. And that's what investors are looking at when they look at the likes of Uber and they look at the likes of Lyft and they look at the likes of Tesla. All of these companies have the potential. We love their products, right? Everybody loves to be able to catch an Uber in 3 to 5 minutes in your front door, nice car, get you to wherever you need to be. Much different than when you called Checkered Cab 10 years ago and it took 45 minutes to get through and then it took another half an hour to have a cab come to your home. Right, there was a real problem with efficiency. It was a broken model, so much so that, for the most part, you didn't even think about getting a cab unless you were close to where there were a bunch of cabs. What did Uber come in and do? Disrupted a business that had a lot of potential to get better. They did that, but right now, with the scale that they have, they can't figure out how to do it and make a profit at the same time. The jury is still out. And investors are giving them that opportunity. They're going to give them arguably several years to eventually get enough scale in the United States and around the globe to say, now we have so much control over the transportation business that we can now, through a variety of new measures, eventually make a profit. Maybe it is autonomous vehicles. Maybe they cut out drivers, which is a scary proposition in itself. Are they really going to have autonomous vehicles that you just direct with an app that just drive you to wherever you need to go? Will they be able to do that? That technology exists. Is that technology safe? The answer is not even close. And the question I have when it comes to autonomous vehicles, and I would love for this to happen. I would love for autonomous vehicles to work. And yes, we see it in Class A trucking. So the big, big rig trucks, what we are seeing in that is we're seeing companies that are able to have the technology to run a Class A truck on the highway. So think of it as exit to exit. Long stretches of highway where it's very predictable, it's a straight road, there are clearly defined lines on the side of the road, there are medians. The technology we have today with cameras, with the visual technology that we have, the LiDAR technology that we have, we can do that. And we can do it in a safe way. What we do not have the ability to do is come off of the highway and move to an unpredictable environment where lacrosse balls or footballs bounce into the road. If you drive by my house, there's a high, high probability that you're going to see some sort, either a dog run out, a puppy run out, a lacrosse ball bounce out, a tennis ball, a football, a soccer ball, and all of a sudden, what does a computer do with that? There are goats and there are chickens and there are llamas that cross the road. I saw a coyote cross the road on a Thursday morning in my neighborhood. I saw a coyote just trot slowly across the road. We live in a very unpredictable transportation environment, and that's what I believe is a long way away from being able to be absolutely safe for computers to take over. But that's part of the business plan. That's part of the business plan for Uber. It's part of the business plan for Lyft. And they're going to say, well, we're not profitable. Well, what if we got rid of all the drivers and we could just do this through technology? Well, maybe that would work. The question I have is, can the technology get that good? And by the way, store that much data and continue to store that much data on a rolling basis that continues to have new information about a road and anything unpredictable, like a branch that falls. We live in the Southeast. The Southeast is known for storms and hurricanes and tornadoes and thunderstorms that change things in our roadway all the time. It's an unpredictable environment. And knowing and having studied autonomous driving over the last several years, and I've got a lot of in my network, we've got a lot of folks that are heavily involved in autonomous driving. They will tell you that sure, the technology exists. If everything remains perfect, as though we build a Lego land and everything remained the same. But what we still don't have the opportunity to do, or we're not really close to being able to continue to remap what's an unpredictable environment. So that's why I have several bets out that autonomous driving in a large way, it exists today, but in a large, deployable, safe way, I think it's a long way away. And that is the question mark and the bet that remains for these big companies that are losing billions of dollars in not years, but in quarters. And that's exactly what is happening with Uber, even though right now the public is giving them a chance, at least for the next several years, and in hopes of an Amazon-like Hail Mary. And that's where we stand. Speaking of another topic, we'll switch to trade for a second, where we don't need a Hail Mary. We just need to punch it into the end zone. That's on trade. That's on trade and tariffs. We're so close to doing this. But last night, the president tweeted out a whole other series of tweets. I think that China, this is from Trump on Twitter, I think that China felt they were being beaten so badly in the recent negotiation that they may as well wait around for the next election in 2020 to see if they could get lucky and have a Democrat win, in which case they would continue to rip off the U.S. for $500 billion a year. The only problem is, and second tweet, the only problem is that they know that I'm going to win. Best economy, employment numbers in U.S. history, and much more. And the deal will become far worse for them if it has to be negotiated my second term. Would be wise for them to act now, but love collecting big tariffs. And that's exactly why, and we're going to talk about a chart that shows exactly the negotiating power that Trump has here with China and exactly what he's doing on trade. Good morning. You are tuned in to Money Matters. The number in the studio is 404-872-0750. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here, WSB Radio. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750. We'll go to the phones here. Andrew and Swanee joins us. Andrew, I was just up in Swanee the other day. It's beautiful country. What's going on? How can I help? Oh, hold on. There we go. Now I can hear you. Andrew? Let's see here. We'll put this on hold, and then we'll try it again. Andrew, can you hear me now? Well, we'll get back to Andrew. Okay. So here's the, and we'll go to the phones then at the bottom of the half hour. This is quick. So again, give us a call in the studio, 404-872-0750. As I try to game out what's going to happen with tariffs. So I get this question, are we going to do this deal or not? The market obviously thinks there's hope to get some sort of deal done. Otherwise the market would have been down 5% this past week. And it was only down about 2%. Last week, after what's been a wonderfully strong run for the year. Why? A, investors look at the Fed and they say, okay, the Fed's on hold. B, the economy is solid on almost every front. And C, we think a trade deal will get done. Or at least the prevailing consensus is, I think we're going to get a trade deal done because China wants to do a trade deal. I think the way I would look at this is that rather than 20 different scenarios, is it going to happen or not this year? Yes or no? I would give it a 70% chance that we'll get a trade deal. 70, 75% chance that we'll get some sort of deal, and a 25 to 30% chance that we're going to have to completely start from scratch and wait until after the 2020 election. Why do we believe that that's going to happen? Well, first of all, you've got to look at when Trump and the Trump administration is playing. When do they play the most hardball? Well, it really started in January of 2018. The end of January, Trump was at Davos. The stock market had just hit an all-time high. This is going all the way back to 2018. January 2018, market all-time high. Wham! Trump says, look, we are going to go hard. We're going to do hard line with China. Market drops all throughout that spring. And took a huge chunk out of stocks. Then eventually stocks recovered until, call it, the fall of 2018. Market hits another all-time high. What happens? Pence comes out with a huge hardline speech against China. Then markets fall and they fall and they fall. And we finally get back to another all-time high in May of 2019, just a couple of weeks ago. And what happens? Wham! Weekend tweets, hardline with China. So we're getting a hardline with China every time the market is at a peak. Why? It gives Trump a ton of negotiating powder, a ton of cushion to get a better deal done for the United States, because he knows it's okay to have 20 or 2, 3, 4, 5% off of markets. And he's a stock market president. He watches every day and he cares. He's looking at it as more cushion to negotiate, more money matters. Straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. Ryan Ely and I are here in the studio. I usually have my kids in here with me and we work on like mothers. So thankfully we've got a couple hours in the morning on Sundays because we wouldn't, you know, our house is kind of chaotic because I've got a bunch of kids, four of them. They're always running around, dogs. We have a puppy, for goodness sakes. So it's hard to get anything really accomplished or done because it's so chaotic. So if we come in here on Sundays and it's quieter and you can actually get some things done. So I have the boys do, and Lynn's not listening. My wife Lynn's not, would never listen to radio. So she's definitely not listening to this. So I can say this. The boys will do like cards and things like that when we're here in the studio, and they have time. And I have a big thing of colored pencils in my bag. And so for the last, call it, month or two, we've been doing these cards for Kate, whatever's coming up. Like my dad has my stepmother 25th wedding anniversary. So we did cards for that. Mother's Day cards we did last week. So we actually have, as opposed to, usually we're scrambling. I'm scrambling to figure out what to do for these, any sort of appreciation oriented holiday. And because we've got some WSB radio time, I actually have some cards in my bag that we can deliver to Miss Lynn Moss for Mother's Day. Like she should anyway, like she deserves, but we actually have it done because the kids are in here. They're not here today. We had one of those 14-hour days in a hot, steamy Saturday yesterday, outside for 14 hours. And the kids are exhausted and they're still asleep when I left today. So gonna let them sleep as long as we can. Anyway, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. Wes Moss, I'm here. I'm your host. We are live here this Sunday morning, like we normally are. Ryan Ely is here with us. And the two of us are here to answer your calls and your questions, whether it has to do with a pension or a mutual fund or an ETF or an annuity or real estate transaction or what to do with the proceeds of a real estate transaction. How do I navigate, or how do you navigate the deal that you're doing right now? Hey, we're selling this, or we're going to buy that. What's the smartest way to do this? Should we pay off a mortgage? Do I need to get another loan? Do I keep this house for rent, or do I sell it and take the cash? Do I use a home equity line for this? Anything that you've been kind of faced with, and this is really what the profession of wealth management is about, is to figure out the optimal strategy for you to move forward. So there's not necessarily ever a perfect or right answer, but there are a set of answers that might really be advantageous for you. And there's a set of outcomes or answers or directions that you may go that might be a disaster. So we're here to try to guide you in the most advantageous way, in an objective way. And that's what we love to do here on Money Matters. So if you have a question that has to do with an IRA or 401k or 403b or TRS, the Teachers Retirement System, or you're at a company that's having a lot of restructuring and they're giving you some sort of offer or buyout, here's a monthly amount you can take forever, or here's a big chunk of money as a lump sum, which is a better deal for you. It's the lump sum versus buyout question, or pension buyout question. We're here to guide you in a way and give you some advice on that. So give us a call here in the studio. The number is 404 872-0750 here on this Sunday morning. Again, the number in the studio, 404-872-0750. So give us a call. Happy to help with those questions that you may have if you've been thinking about this all week. Also, if you're outside of Georgia, 1-800-WSB-TALK is the number here in the studio. Again, 1-800-WSB-TALK or 1-800-972-8255. And we're happy to go to the phones and do what we can to guide you in the right way. We're going to start with Andrew in Swanee. Andrew, what's going on? How can we help?
Hey, Wes.
Hey, man.
I'm 55. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Great. So 55, heading into the last 10 years towards retirement, I've got funds across Vanguard and Fidelity. Both of them offer both advice, or they'll also offer to manage my funds. And then I also, you know, there's some other fiduciaries I'm kind of looking at and talking through and just trying to get a good mental model around, should I be looking at someone to help manage the money for the last 10 years heading into retirement, moving from wealth, you know, retirement building, moving into income investing and those kinds of things. And just, what are your thoughts on that?
It's a little bit of a philosophical question. So I think what Andrew's asking here, so if you're in the car and you're listening, you're thinking, what did Andrew really ask? I think what you're asking is that do you do this on your own? Do you continue to manage your money, your finances, your tax, all of the wealth management, anything that falls under that umbrella? Do you continue to do it on your own, which you've been doing and probably successfully doing? Or do you have somebody help you with it? Which the big question there is that if somebody's helping you with it, you got to pay them something, right? So it's, do you have wealth management and pay for it in some way, shape or form, or do you continue to do it on your own? And here's my thought on this. Wealth management is, particularly in the day we live, in the time that you and I are living in right now, Andrew, wealth management is an innovation, and it's been an innovation for, call it 100 years. There was a time, Andrew, that when only a handful of families, the robber barons, by the way, if you owned a railroad, maybe you were in this camp, that and let's call it the few titans of wealth in America. Let's go back 100-150 years. Those were the families that had. They're the only people that had access to capital and the opportunity to participate in, let's call it, the most profitable deals or the most profitable companies in the world. And we went a long time in history when that continued to be the case. Technology in the last 30 years has really made it so that anyone can do this, at least on some scale. It still may be on a smaller scale, but at least you can participate, right? You can participate in it's something as simple as the S&P 500. So you can start to harness some of the best companies in the world as well. But when it comes down to advice, I think this is where, in the real world, this is kind of what happens. I think about 30% of, well, and this is from many studies, actually from Vanguard, will tell you this. About a third, or let's call it 33%, let's call it a third of the population likes to manage their money on their own, is managing their money on their own, and their other finances, call it wealth management, tax, anything that has to do with lending, and they do that on their own, and they're fine with that, and that's how they like it to be. They like the control, and they like doing it, quite frankly. Then you have another two-thirds of the population, maybe even call it 70%, that does want some sort of advice. And that's, I think, where that you're kind of figuring this out right now. Which camp do you go in? And that percentage, though, Andrew, I think gets the larger your asset base gets and the closer you get to an event like retirement and needing it, it becomes more emotional because you have a lot more at stake, right? You've got a lot more money at stake. And the percentage swings on $1 million or $2 million or $5 million in dollar terms become a really big deal, right? When you're getting started and you got 10 grand, a 10% move doesn't faze you because a 10% move in your wealth may only be a couple hundred dollars, maybe a grand. So it doesn't impact you emotionally all that much. But when you get to the point where you're right before retirement, you're in your mid 50s or in your 60s, now you've got a lot of money, I think the right kind of objective or fundamentally sound advice can easily be worth millions and millions of dollars over your lifetime. And here's the other part of it. And this is part of my research for You Can Retire Sooner Than You Think when it comes to money and happiness, is that there's a real emotional, or you can call it emotional, Andrew, you could call it a psychological dividend that you're getting help that could be priceless. I think about my father, who has financially been pretty successful guy. He's a veterinarian, right? Done well for 30 some years, always made a good living, been a good saver, but he's financially phobic. Like, he hates even talking about money, let alone investments. Doesn't want to talk about it, just doesn't like it, right? So there's a percentage of the population that absolutely needs advice because they just don't even want to deal with it. They'll put it under a rock. And I can tell you, and this is why I know that wealth management, or at least advice, can be so valuable over time. Just imagine that you do zero and you have no enlightenment whatsoever. You don't ever think about your taxes. You don't ever think about your mortgage. You don't ever think about your investments. Think about how much money I guarantee you. I guess I can't even, you're not allowed to say the word guarantee in our business. So there's a very high likelihood that in the end of the final analysis over 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it would look like a disaster, right? If you didn't do anything or think about wealth management, I can tell you that you would leave millions of dollars on the table, right? So I'm a believer of at least getting some sort of advice over time. And another Vanguard study shows that wealth management, if you're doing it and you find somebody that's objective, right, that is not just selling you a product and getting a commission. If you find somebody's objective that is set up to work with you over time, that can be really, really valuable. So, and again, I'm biased here. I'm biased, Andrew, because I've been in the wealth management industry for over 20 years now. So I'm a believer that in the world we live in today, yes, the right advice that's objective, and that's the key word there. Some firms are, some firms aren't, can be hugely helpful. And I'm waiting for you to respond.
Oh, yes. No, I think that makes sense. It's kind of like I can get advice on a basis and balance on my own, or I can pay a fee and say, hey, in the last 10 years of my retirement, I can let them sort of keep an eye and move things to make sure I'm heading towards a good place in retirement. And so that management fee becomes a bit of a risk, a bit of an insurance kind of thing. And so that's what I'm trying to just get a good mental model around. It sounds like it's some good advice to be ready, especially heading into retirement, to make sure I don't make some moves that could really risk that capital.
Yeah, think about it. And this is the other thought. I think it's getting easier as an individual or a family to get advice that's really worth it today more than it was 20 years ago, because the costs have come down. It used to be you pay advisors 2-2.5% a year. You buy an annuity, it's 3% a year. It used to be really detrimental. Today, the costs have come down quickly and dramatically because of ETFs and low-cost index-type fund investing, and it's brought the cost on everything down a lot. So now I think what you get today, Andrew, is arguably much better financial advice. More and more folks out there are objective for a lower cost, and I'd say dramatically lower cost than you even got 10 years ago, because the cost of the industry has come down. So to me, and it's more than just investments, it's how your investments play into your tax situation, which we know can be a huge, huge swing in what you keep at the end of the day, the sequence of how you distribute your money in a tax efficient way, where do you draw from with your portfolio, and avoiding those pitfalls, to your point, again, can be really, really advantageous to sidestep. And I think in the world we live in today, you can do it on a basis today that is less expensive than it's ever been. And I think that to answer your question, I believe that wealth management for a big chunk, 2/3, 70% of the population, is absolutely worth the price of admission. Good morning. Great. Welcome to Money Matters. Yeah, thank you for your call. The number here in the studio, 404-872-0750, or wesmoss.com to find me and the Money Matters team throughout the week. Thank you. Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. WSB Radio, Wes Moss here as your host. We continue to go to the phones, 404-872-0750. Wayne from Lake Oconee. Wayne, what's going on? How can I help?
Hey, I've got a rental house, and I'm wondering, should I sell it or not? It's worth about $140,000. It brings in $1,000 a month in rental income. And on the house at Oconee, I've got a mortgage of about $1,500 a month, and I'm thinking maybe I should sell the rental house and take the $140 and put it down on the mortgage.
Take the money and run. My thought here, Wayne, so you're getting a grand a month, so $12,000 divided by $140. You have a cap. What the real estate guys would say is a cap rate of 8.5%. It's okay. I'd like to see I'd like to see that more like 1% a month or 12% gross cap rate, because you've got basically your yield. I think of real estate like a bond with a lot more work, right? This is the value. This is what's paying me every month. But the cool thing about real estate and why I like to maybe I would err to the side of holding it is that you can inflate the rent. So it's almost like a floating rate bond. I believe that. So where would you need to be at 140? At 12%, you'd need about $16,000 a year in rent, right? Divided by 140 to get you 12%. So you need to be at, here's what I'd like to see you raise the rent to over time. You're charging a grand a month. If you slowly raise that, Wayne, if you got that to $1,400 a month, which isn't a crazy jump from where you are, now you've got a property that is a 12% yielder, and that's gross. So let's say you net down to 8% in the end of the year. That's a really good long-term investment to hold. It's hard. It's really hard to find that kind of yield or cash flow distribution anywhere else. So you're really close to making that happen. And this is the great thing about having real estate. You can inflate the rent. So if you think that you've got some to push that $1,000 a month to $1,100 next year or $1,200, and over the next couple of years get it to $1,400 a month, now you've got a property that's yielding you 12% a year gross, which is something I'd want to hang on to. Wayne, thank you for your call, my friend. More Money Matters at the 10 o'clock hour, straight ahead.
WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss, certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters 10 o'clock hour. Wes Moss here, Sunday mornings. It's like it's just going to be a rainy day. Ryan is so mad because his tea times just canceled all of them. I don't know. What are you doing on a rainy day? Well, hang out. Listen to some Money Matters. Give us a call. You're going to be inside for a while after church, of course. Or maybe you're finished church in the parking lot and you're ready to drive home. We're here. We're hanging out. It's time to chat. And if you have questions throughout the week you've been thinking about, then we'd love to answer them for you here on this Sunday morning. Already a lot of great calls. Today, we give you our best direction we can give you, objective advice. We've been doing that for many, many years now, and we look forward to many more doing so. So give us a call when you have a question. For the number here in the studio, 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. We'll go to the phones when Ryan tells me where to go. But there's just a couple of, you know, I look at this week and here we are. It's been a good year so far for stocks, right? We know that up 11% for the Dow, up almost 15% on the S&P 500. And that's after a really tough week. We're down what seemed like just day after day after day. And we rallied a little bit towards the end. We ended up down still over 2% for the Dow and over 2% for the S&P 500. The NASDAQ was down over 3%. So we had some air let out of let out of space and we've fallen back down to earth a little bit. Part of that is the fact that when it comes to negotiating this trade deal, and this is what it is, it's a massive negotiation. I believe this is a very much a stock market president. He cares about the market. He watches the stock market. He wants the stock market to do well and knows that the way I look at this is that anytime things get really good, if you go back and look at a chart, every single time we've taken a harder line with China on the trade front, the market has been right at an all-time high. I don't think it's a coincidence. Maybe the first time, yes. Second time, yes. Third time, no. And we've had now three times in a row over the past year and a half where our toughest talk, our most significant rhetoric about getting not just a deal with China, but a better deal has come at the S&P 500 all-time high. Why does the president feel as though he can do something at that point? This is just my opinion on it, is that we've got a cushion. Hey, market's up 15%. Even if it dropped 5%, we're still up 10%, so the market's still pretty good. And that is this cushion, I believe, that we have the administration that's using. Things go well in the economy. Things go well in the stock market. To me, if you look, again, look at this chart, it makes it abundantly clear that this is simply Trump being Trump as a negotiator. We talked about this in 2018. We knew that 2019, pre-election, it's the third year of the presidential cycle. We know that presidents historically, and this is very clear in history, that third-year presidents play ball. And in order to play ball, Trump wants to get some sort of trade deal done. They play ball because they know that this has to be a good year for the economy. It has to be a good year for the stock market in order to get reelected in 2020. So the higher stocks go, the more Trump has cover or cushion to play hardball. Stock market up 17%? That's fine. Throw a massive negotiating twist in the game, and maybe we get more out of the deal. Remember, Trump doesn't just want a deal. The administration just they can do a deal tomorrow. They could sign a piece of paper tomorrow. Hey, we did a trade deal with China. They want a good deal. They want a deal that's good for the economy. They want a good deal and they want a sustainable deal. Otherwise, it's not worth doing it. Now, at the same time, I do realize that the world that we live in is, you have a good week, things are going great, everything's wonderful, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue, you get weeks like this. Over the weekend, Trump tweet, next thing you know, market's down 500 points in a day. That happens all the time. And that's part of what makes investing so difficult, because it's an emotional sport. And you think to yourself, well, this was bad. Can it get or will it get worse? And the answer is that at some point, sometimes it does. So it's a scary world we live in. And I want to talk about this. This is this notion of this tailwind that Warren Buffett recently talked about in his 2019 letter, or for last year, 2018. Just this week, great example. Not only are we going back into this trade fight or skirmish or war, you end up with North Korea fires two short-range missiles. Okay. Pyongyang's weapon tests heighten pressure on Washington to address stalled nuclear talks. And then what did we do? Well, we went and we seized a North Korean ship. And the list goes on and on and on. That's on top of this trade war. So the fear, and it's always about what potentially could be happening, the fear of real war, the fear of an economic war, and then what does that do to markets? Which again takes me back and reminds me of Buffett's story that we started to highlight last week. This notion of an American tailwind. It's an American tailwind. So Buffett recently wrote about his last 77 years. Basically, when he started to invest until today, it's been about 77 years. He invests his initial $114 that turned into over $600,000. Let's do the math again. $114 turned into over $600,000 if it were just in the S&P 500, which is an 11.8% return. During that same 77-year period, $114 in gold turned into $4,200 in gold. So gold, the protector, the safe haven of gold, got to less than 1% of what stocks would have done over that same period of time. You put $1 million in stocks 77 years ago, that'd now be $5.3 billion. That's all at 11.8%. So you're at 5,288, so almost 5,300 to one. 5,300 to one. 1942 until early 2019. That's just the math of what's happened because of the American tailwind. All of that time, an American tailwind. And during that same period of time, it's not as though things were rosy here all the time in America. And not just weeks. We're talking, we've had years and years of really awful economic times, scary geopolitical times. Debt, our national debt grew 400-fold during that same period of time when Warren Buffett's $114 would have turned into $600,000. Debt, 400-fold. That's a 40,000% increase in debt over that same period of time. How about governments? Well, as that same period of time, we saw control. Seven times we saw control from Republicans. Seven times we saw control from Democrats. Did we see calamity? Yes, we saw calamity. Inflation, 21% prime rate at one point. Wars, the resignation of a president. We saw a 30%, really up an 80% drop in some markets for housing prices, and that was just in 07, 08. I believe there's not only an American tailwind, though, and this is where we bring us up to today. It's 2019. It's not only an American tailwind that we're living in. There's a global tailwind as well. And because the U.S. is that most stable nation on the globe, Ryan and I were just talking about this in break. We're talking about folks said, hey, I want to take my money and get out of the United States. I want to take it somewhere else, right? What happens when things get really rough economically or politically in, let's say, China or Brazil or maybe Europe? Where do those people want to go? They want to come here because this is where we have safety of money. This is where we have rule of law. This is where your bank account's your bank account, right? It's like, I want to take my money to Costa Rica. I want to go to Ecuador. I don't know. Take your money to the moon. Is it safer on the moon? To Ryan's point, when things get really tough here, they're worse outside of our borders. So money comes here. People are fighting to get in the United States. They're fighting to get to North America. I was just in Vancouver, right? People are fighting to get into Canada, for God's sakes. Now, I will say Vancouver is an amazing place. But people are fighting from all over the world to come here to North America, to here to the United States, primarily. So I believe there's not only this American tailwind that Buffett talks about, but there's a global tailwind. And because we are the most stable part of that global ecosystem, and this is where where we live in today will continue to attract the most amount of money. You know, we're the most, you know that we're the most entrepreneurial planet on the globe, the hardest working country on the globe, the most enterprising country in the world. And we are able then to harness that. We're able to get the global tailwind here in the United States. U.S. companies now more than ever harness progress here and abroad. And the world keeps getting better and better. Again, headlines scary every day, but the book that gets written year by year and really decade by decade. So again, headlines for the day. The book that you care about is one that is chapters long. It is year by year, decade by decade. And here's what the book looks like. The book looks like now. You know, crime in the United States, according to Gallup polls, going back to the 90s, back to 1990, the vast majority, 70 to 85% of Americans believe that crime is getting worse in this country. That's not so. Since 1990, the number of crimes reported in the United States has dropped from 14.5 million to under 9.5 million, representing a massive decline. 5 million fewer crimes in U.S. cities than only back in 1990. And the list goes on. I mean, you look at clean water, plane crash fatalities, the number of nuclear warheads, fatalities from natural and technological disasters, mobile phones, immunizations, hunger, poverty. the improvements we have seen over the last even 20 years are so dramatic that it's really a global tailwind that feeds and makes the American tailwind even more powerful than it's ever been. We're going to run to weather traffic, which I want to listen to weather here, weather traffic, then more Money Matters here in the 10 o'clock hour straight ahead. Welcome back to Money Matters. Good morning. Wes Moss here every Sunday morning, along with Ryan Ealy, to take your calls and your questions here on Money Matters. 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. We go to Scott in Johns Creek. Scott, good morning. How can we help?
Good morning. About a month ago, I lost my wife. And,
oh, no. Sorry, Scott.
Thank you. And she had a non-IRA account that was about $900,000. Now, my understanding is that we had a transfer on death feature in the account, and that there will be a step up in cost basis. My question, though, is there are some stocks in the account that are actually showing a net loss. Is a situation like this, do they simply take the entire bulk of the account and just do an average and for your step up, or is there some other calculation that is done for cost basis purpose?
Okay, so Scott, the way this works is that if you are, because this is a TOD account, which stands for transfer on death, it really was in one name. And then it goes to you, as opposed to a joint account, which is I would be giving you a different answer here. But if it's a TOD account, is very different than a joint account. And in this case, the way it works is that each position gets a brand new basis. So every single position, whether you had a gain or there was, let's call it a loss originally, it just gets reset. So the reason we talk about step up in basis is that more times than not, if we are inheriting money, it's from maybe a long time ago, and basis on a stock was 20 originally. Today it's, let's say, 100. Then the 100 is your new basis for that particular position. But it also works the other way too. If let's say the basis on a stock was 100 and you inherit it at 50, well, 50 is your new basis. So we technically get a step up or a step down because it's a brand new cost basis scenario at the day effectively this happens. And in a joint account, it gets a little more complicated because if a stock is owned in joint name, then you actually get what's called a half step up in basis, and you have to do the math to figure that part out. But in the particular account where you're talking about, is Scott, it is a brand new basis for you as opposed to having to do the math on a joint account. That's the way a TOD works.
Okay.
Scott, sorry for your loss, my friend. That's awful. And it's so awful when you're dealing with loss and then you got to deal with the money side of it. It's just an emotionally tough thing. So hang in there, my friend. I wish you the best. God bless you. Stay tuned. More Money Matters right here on News 95.5 and AM 750. Well, good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on WSB Radio. Wes Moss here, Ryan Ealy. To take your calls and your questions. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. Let's go to the phones here. Again, the number here in the studio, phone lines are open, 404-872-0750, whether it's a Roth question or an IRA question or a real estate question. Maybe it has something to do with a mutual fund, an ETF, exchange-traded fund, an annuity, or something to do with taxes, investment taxes. Give us a call here in the studio. Phone lines are open. Love to take your call and question and try to help steer you in the right direction. 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. It's 800-972-8255 is the number here in the studio. We'll start with Ron and Marietta. Hey, Ron, what's going on, man?
Oh, just got two questions for you, Wes.
Uh-oh. Okay. Two for one. Two for one special on Money Matters today.
Well, good. I appreciate that. Well, the first one has to do with the if you have managed money in an IRA, what kind of management fee structure should you expect? I assume it's going to be the management fee would be based on the amount of money invested that is under management.
Yeah,
is that like a 1% or a 2% or a 0.5% or what kind of should that come in?
Yeah, that's an important piece of the equation. We talked a little bit about this earlier today. It's kind of like when do you get wealth management, right? When do you pay for advice or not? And if you're somebody that wants some help over time, and I think that's a big percentage of America that at some point feels as though their portfolio is at the size where they don't want to mess it up, so they get help. And if you go back over time, let me frame it this way. It's less about the headline percentage and more about your all-in cost. And I say that because when I was first in the investment business 20 some years ago, the advisors routinely charged 1% a year, 1.5% a year. It skewed one and higher. But that was not it, Ron. There was another layer or two of fees routinely. So yeah, you might add 1% a year, 1.5% a year 20, 25 years ago. But then you paid a bunch of mutual fund fees and you paid tons of other fees. So you really were paying like 2, 3% every single year. And the good news about today, it's a lot like, I mean, flat screen TVs, right? I live in a house with four boys. So unfortunately, we've had some broken TVs from footballs and I don't know, baseball bats that have errantly hit the TV. And I still have this reaction and I still get angry and mad that I have to go buy a TV. But what I've also learned is that, you know, 15 years ago to buy a nice TV, it was like several thousands of dollars, right? It was $2,500 for a nice TV. It was more than that. The further you go back, the more expensive. Today, I've learned to buy ultra cheap TVs, right? I can just go to Target and I can get a TV for $250 that's just as good as my TV was 10 years ago that was $3,000, right? The same thing's happened to wealth management. You've gotten the mutual fund costs and exchange traded fund costs and all these other costs that are really arguably the most, where the most fat was to get cut out. In the investment industry, a lot of that has been cut out, or you have the opportunity to cut that out. So now, instead of having another layer or two of a 1 or 2% inside all these funds, that's coming down to less than 0.5%, call it 0.25% in some cases, like 0.1%, right? So things have been getting less expensive. So that's great. The wealth management is still in that 1% range. It's 1%, some are a little more than 1. I think it's skewing these days 1% and maybe slightly under that, call it 0.8, 0.9. Is about where you typically are going to see firms charge if you have a real live person with real live experience, certified financial planner, kind of long list, because it's hard economically to have a model where it's anything less than that. I've heard of programs where you're paying $30 a month or $50 a month for a certified financial planner. The problem is it's somebody in another state in a call center that's going to maybe be there for a year, and you're going to get a new person and a new person and a new person. So it's a commodity-based version of planning. And there's so much trust needed in wealth management and so much depth of situation needed in order to really give you the right answers that I think you need somebody that really knows you or has a relationship. And I think that still holds true to this day. So the answer is, anything around 1% or less all in, which includes your advisor fee. And then if you, the underlying costs of the investments, those fees, Ron, that I think whether it's an IRA or a taxable account should be in the 1% range or lower. And I think that was just one of your questions, Ron.
Right. And that was, thank you for that. A very complete answer. The other question has to do kind of with the other end of it, I guess. you have an account holder who is, say, 75 years old, has been drawing an RMD off of their IRA, and they pass, and the IRA is inherited by an offspring that is, say, 50 years old.
An offspring. Okay. I love that. It's an offspring. It sounds like a horror movie. Offspring. But Ron,
well,
the,
in some cases that might
you,
apply.
What again, for our listeners, the reason that's, it's important that it's an offspring and not a spouse is the rules are different. So a non-spouse and someone who's not the spouse of someone pass or inherits an IRA, they were already taking their required minimum distribution. That, okay, so that's the question here?
That's correct, yeah. The account holder has been drawing the RMD, and now a non-spousal inheritor is sub, you know, they say 50 years old, not required to take an RMD under normal circumstances. Are they now required to take the RMD?
The answer is yes. The way the rules work is if you were already, if the IRA already had required minimum distributions coming out, and someone, even though they may not inherit it at, let's say, 50, and they, even though that's not the 70 and a half, we all know that that's when you have to start taking those required minimums. The answer is they do have to start taking required minimum distributions. Now, what they can do, or what they certainly can do, is do that based on their life expectancy, which is longer, which means the RMDs are less, right? So there's a table of when you get an what's called an inherited IRA, or we call this a beneficiary IRA. The beneficiary, it's now their beneficiary IRA. It doesn't go into their personal. It's not like a personal IRA because the way the IRS looks at this is says, hey, this was already taking required minimum. So do you, but we'll let you do it on your life expectancy. So the RMDs are less, which is a good thing, but you still have to take money out. Now, one caveat to that is that we haven't really talked a ton about this yet, but there's a lot of retirement reform, Ron, in the pipeline. There's a bill called this is from the House Ways and Means Committee. Very recently, just in March, is proposing a new bill on changing, really a retirement bill in America. It's called the SECURE Bill, which is a long acronym. It's Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement Act. That's proposing some new rules for RMDs to make it so that you don't get to stretch the distributions out as long as you do today. Remember, the government is, you've been able to put money in for, let's call it, 50 years in a tax advantageous way. You got a deduction typically, or you didn't have to pay taxes because it was in a 401k. Now you rolled it to an IRA. And then they say, hey, wait a minute. Now we're going to force you to pull money out so that you can now pay taxes on that money that comes out. You pay ordinary income taxes on that. So the government looks at this and they're like, oh, wait a minute. How can we get more money out of you? How can we get more taxes out of Ron? And the answer would be, or Ron's heirs or your beneficiaries, is to say, hey, you know, no longer can you spread this out over from age 50 all the way to age 100. Now you got to take it out over a shorter period of time. Now, that's just a bill. Nothing's been passed. But the way the rules work today is that your beneficiary is going to be able to stretch. In fact, they call it, very often this is referred to, a stretch IRA. Stretch that required minimum distribution out over their entire lifetime. Ron, listen, thank you for your call, my friend. Thanks for calling into Money Matters. Thanks for listening to the show, and have a wonderful rest of your Sunday. Good morning. That's an important call, and we haven't really talked about retirement reform, but I think one thing that I don't love that you are forced to take money out of your IRA. I don't love that if you don't need it, and this happens very often. If you're a diligent saver, and if you save for 50 years, you've also saved outside of an IRA. You've maybe saved in a Roth account. You've saved in a taxable account. You've saved in a tax deferred account. You've got all these places you've saved money, and if you've really done an awesome job at this, then you may not really. You may say, well, if I don't need to take my IRA, I'm not going to touch it. right? I'm going to pass that on. But the government makes it so that you do so. And they say, well, no, you have to take money out. That way you get ordinary income. It creates ordinary income when you pull money out, or you're forced to, and you're required minimum distribution. And then the government collects taxes on that. The one of the other proposals, so there's a House version and there's a Senate version of this. One of the versions, again, this is retirement reform we're talking about here, extends that age out potentially. So instead of 70 and a half, there are some proposals on the table that take that, I think, to 71, 72, because these have not been updated for a very long time. And arguably, when that age was put in place, life expectancy in America was different than it is today. And that's just like so many rules that we have, or so many laws are based on the census or life expectancy tables that are outdated, and they haven't been adjusted for inflation. And that's why we have to continue to have reform to kind of get with what the times that we live in, because we don't retire on average at 64 anymore and die at 67. That doesn't happen in mass anymore. We're living longer. The rules when it comes to our money and retirement should reflect the life expectancy and the ages that we live in today's world. And in a lot of cases, they just don't do that. So I'm excited that we're finally getting some reform on the table. And I think that's obviously a topic for another Money Matters. And we'll talk about what some of these bills, the House bill, the Senate bill, what they're proposing when it comes to updating or changing the retirement rules around required minimum distributions, small 401k plans in the United States, and there's really a whole host of other reforms that are on the table that can have a really dramatic impact on the retirement planning environment in the United States. We'll see how that, we'll see if it happens, but we'll preview that here on Money Matters. Good morning. You're listening to Money Matters. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here every Sunday morning, along with Ryan Ely, and we are the Money Matters team. We've been doing this for well over a decade. And if you'd like to find us throughout the week, it's easy to do so. You can go to our website. You can go to wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com. Our articles are laid out in Money, Adventure, Social, and Health. Those are the four cornerstones of living a happy retirement, living a retirement with longevity, and leading a retirement that's financially set up to do the things that you would like to do with the freedom that you would like to have. That's how all of our articles are laid out. So it's at go to wesmoss.com. There's a contact button in the upper right-hand corner. So if you have questions that impact your retirement, maybe it's an investment question or investment or taxes or real estate, we're here to help throughout the week. And if it gets a little more complicated and you don't get a chance to call in, then we're happy to discuss throughout the week. Stay tuned. More Money Matters right here on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here. Sunday morning. It's raining. 66 degrees on Peachtree. After what became a hot and humid Saturday here in Atlanta. Ryan Ely, we've got a prize pack. What's going on?
The weekend prize pack is a pair of tickets to see Rascal Flatts with special guests Lee Bryce and Morgan Evans Saturday, May 25th at Ameris Bank Amphitheater in Alpharetta. Tickets are on sale now at livenation.com. Caller number 7, Rascal Flatts tickets are yours.
That's the prize line at 404-741-0750. We had a jobs report recently in May. Still, labor market. Let's do a pulse check on the labor market. Strong headline numbers, solid. 263,000 new jobs in April, revised the prior month up by 16, or revisions are up 16,000, and really across the board, production gains, construction, manufacturing, private service, all higher and robust. Temporary jobs also helped April. Those are strong. And that's a good sign too. As temporary jobs get added, it means that employers are testing the waters and saying, oh, maybe we don't want to commit fully to these jobs, but we're going to hire temporary folks as well. And that can lead to further employment gain. So all really a very, very solid jobs report. Weekly hourly, weekly hours were a tiny bit weaker. So they dipped just slightly. Labor force participation rate dropped ever so slightly from 63% to 62.8%. But here we are with unemployment in the United States of America down to 3.6%. 3.6% unemployment in the United States of America. And that's exactly where we want to be. That means over 96% of the country is employed, looking for work, not looking for work, in the labor market and has a job. Over 96% employment. Strong report. Next Sunday, we're going to do a complete economic rundown. Consumer spending, housing, inflation, manufacturing, employment, earnings, you name it. Our Chime economic update coming up next Sunday here on Money Matters. Have a wonderful rest of your Sunday. You can find us at wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Enjoy this wonderful Sunday. God bless. And stay tuned to the best program on the planet. News 95.5 AM 750 WSB.